Finding the time to get a lab test is almost impossible. But now it's easy to order the tests you want at everlywell.com. Everlywell is an at-home health testing company that offers a variety of physician-reviewed private tests, from food sensitivity to metabolism to thyroid. No more sitting in waiting rooms or waiting on your results. Head on over to everlywell.com and use promo code JUNKIE to take 15% off your first order. Everlywell, your test on your time and on your terms.
My name is Jenna Miglio. I was Sherry's cousin, technically probably my dad's first cousin, so my second cousin. My dad was also her godfather and grew up with her, you know, until she passed away. I live in Chicago. I was a little bit farther from Sherry. Obviously, she was in more Columbia, Illinois, which is a little bit closer to St. Louis, but we still had a very close relationship all throughout college. And even before that, we had a lot of similar interests, and so we kept a really close relationship.
A little over 9 years ago, when Jenna Miglio was 19 years old, she received some news about her cousin, 31-year-old Sherry Coleman, news that would make her fall to the floor in disbelief. Sherry and her two young sons, 11-year-old Garrett and 9-year-old Gavin, had been found dead in their own home, in their own beds. And worse, it would very soon come to light that it had been intentional, that they were murdered. The shock of losing them was bad enough, but once Jenna's family found out who did it and why, it would shake them to the core. Things as they knew it weren't what they had seemed.
Just after everything happened and everything came out, it was just like, oh my God, there was like such a secret life going on that none of us had ever even imagined was going on.
This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 56. Today's case starts back in November 2008 in Columbia, Illinois, a small St. Louis suburb. Chris and Sherry Coleman, along with their two sons, Garrett and Gavin, lived in a beautiful two-story home in the Columbia Lakes subdivision.
Honestly, they were like, when I remember being younger and thinking like, wow, this is exactly what you hope to grow up and the type of family and husband that you hope to have out of life. They were, her and Chris, first of all, you know, just from when I was young at the time, I was in high school and like just kind of starting college, but they were very much in love. And I remember, you know, kind of, he would send her these really cute, sweet text messages, like when they weren't together. Sometimes she would come into Chicago and he would not come with, or he would be on a business trip or something like that. And he would send her these really nice text messages. And, you know, it was sweet. But as a high school kid, I was like, oh my God, that's like, you know, what you want when you grow up. And those boys were so polite, so energetic, smart, funny, like everyone, you know, any word that you can use to describe them as positive, they were.
But in November 2008, something eerie started happening. The family started receiving death threats, first via email. At 12:51 p.m. on November 18th, 2008, Chris went to the Columbia Police Department to report it. He said he had received two emails to his work email address, threatening his family. He told police that he believed that it was because of his occupation. He was the personal bodyguard for Joyce Meyer, a Christian author and speaker who travels around the world giving speeches and holding conventions. And it wasn't odd to think that Joyce could have enemies. Just 5 years earlier, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch published a four-part article detailing Joyce's lavish lifestyle, including her $10 million corporate jet, her husband's Mercedes worth more than $100,000, her $2 million home, and $20 million headquarters. While Joyce maintained that there was, quote, no need for us to apologize for being blessed, the reports prompted a Christian watchdog group to call on the IRS to investigate Joyce and her family, but no wrongdoing was ever found. Chris showed the police officers the email, which was from the email address destroychris@gmail.com. It read, Tell Joyce to stop preaching the bullshit or Chris's family will die. If I can't get to Joyce, then I will get to someone close to her. And if I can't get to him, then I will kill his wife and kids. I know Joyce's schedule so that I know Chris's schedule. If Joyce doesn't quit preaching the bullshit, then they will die. During the Houston conference, I will kill them all as they sleep. If I don't hit there, then I will kill them during the book tour or the trip to India. I know where he lives, and I know they are alone. Fuck them all, and they will die soon. Chris said his coworkers received emails too, threatening to kill Chris's family while he was out of town, traveling with Joyce. He requested extra patrol of his residence during his upcoming trip to Houston, and police obliged. Less than 2 months later, on January 2, 2009, Chris summoned police to his home, this time to report a threatening letter he had received in his mailbox. Chris told the responding officer that he had gone out to his mailbox at about noon when he opened it and found a piece of paper that read, "Fuck you. Deny your God publicly or else. No more opportunities. Time is running out for you and your family. Have a good time in India, motherfucker." Chris told the officer that he didn't know who delivered the letter, but that he was afraid and concerned for his family while he went out of the country on business. The department again assigned extra patrol units to the neighborhood. 3 months later, April 27, 2009, and police were again responding to the Coleman home. Another threatening letter had been found in their mailbox. Chris told the responding officer, Officer Sean Westfall, that Sherry had gotten the mail earlier that day, around 3 p.m., but that he didn't know that, so he went out to check around 6 p.m., and when he did, he found another letter. Quote, "Fuck you. I am giving you the last warning. You have not listened to me and you have not changed your ways. I have warned you to stop traveling and to stop carrying on with this fake religious life of stealing people's money. You think you are so special to do what you do, protecting, or think you are protecting her. She is a bitch and not worth you doing it. Stop today or else. I know your schedule. You can't hide from me ever. I'm always watching. I know when you leave in the morning, and I know when you stay home. I saw you leave this morning. I will be watching. You better stop traveling and doing what you are doing. This is my last warning. Your worst nightmare is about to happen." Chris told Officer Westfall that Joyce gets threats all the time, and that he had received threatening letters before, that this was the most specific and longest one. He said Sherry had received another letter a few weeks prior, on April 6th, while Chris was away on a work trip, and that she had turned the letter over to the police too. He again said that he has no idea who could be sending the letters, but pointed out that the person really might know his schedule, since Joyce's speaking engagements are advertised. He said he put up surveillance cameras at his home, but that they didn't come with a power source, so he was still waiting for them to come in. Officer Westfall decided to do a canvas of the neighborhood to see if any of the Colemans' neighbors had noticed anything suspicious, particularly between the times of 3 p.m. when Sherry got the mail to 6 p.m. when Chris found the letter in the mailbox. He came up empty. No one had seen or heard anything suspicious. But when he stopped over at Justin Barlow's house, a Columbia detective sergeant who happened to live kitty-corner from the Colemans, Detective Barlow offered to put up cameras in his own home, directed at the Coleman house, for additional surveillance. At about 6:50 a.m. on Tuesday, May 5th, 2009, Detective Barlow woke up to his cell phone ringing. It was Chris Coleman, who told him that he had left for the gym earlier that morning and had tried to call Sherry to make sure that she was up with the kids, but was getting no response. He was worried that something was wrong. He said he was crossing the Jefferson Barracks Bridge and would be home in about 5 minutes, but asked if Detective Barlow could go over to the house to try and make contact with Sherry. Detective Barlow got out of bed, got dressed, and called the Columbia Police Department to let them know what was going on. He asked for a uniformed patrol officer to meet him at the Coleman house. When he walked over, he looked in the windows next to the door and saw that all the lights were off in the house. He rang the doorbell, but got no answer. Officer Jason Donjon pulled up, and Barlow told him how no one was answering the door. So Donjon walked around to the rear of the house and saw that the basement rear window was open. The screen to the window was leaning against a patio chair on the grass. He radioed to both dispatch and to Barlow, who was still at the front of the house, and told them about the window. Barlow walked over, and they called for more backup. Barlow and Donjon removed their guns from their holsters and entered the basement through the open window. Barlow went first. He noticed that when he put his foot down on the floor, the bottom of his shoe was wet from the moisture that had come from the grass outside, and his shoes made a wet, squeaky noise as he walked across the hardwood floors. Donjon shouted, "Columbia Police!" several times, but there was no answer. They searched the basement, but didn't find anything out of the ordinary. No broken glass, no signs of a struggle, and no grass clippings from the outside. They slowly made their way up the basement stairs to the main floor, and what they discovered up there was bizarre, to say the least. First came the fresh smell of spray paint. Then, on the walls in the kitchen, were messages scrawled in red spray paint. One message was hard to read, but definitely contained the word fuck, and the other one read, "I am always watching." There were also scrawlings on the living room wall and on the wall going up the staircase to the second floor. Just then, they heard the garage door open. Chris was home. They called out to him to stay outside until they finished searching. Chris asked, "What's going on? What's going on?" Officer Steve Patton pulled up just then to help them with the search. He, too, told Chris to remain outside until they were finished. The three officers made their way up to the second floor. When Donjon reached the top of the stairs, he looked to his left, towards the master bedroom. He saw a white female lying face down on her stomach on the bed. She appeared to be naked. He yelled, "Columbia Police," but she didn't move. He radioed the dispatcher and told them he needed an ambulance. Meanwhile, Barlow had gone to the first bedroom on the right. He saw a young boy, whom he would later determine to be 11-year-old Garrett Coleman, lying in bed on his left side, with a blanket covering his lower body. He was motionless. Barlow noticed red spray paint on the boy's blanket. He felt Garrett's neck for a pulse, but there was none. The young boy was dead. Barlow met Officer Patton in the hallway, who told him that there was another young boy in the second bedroom who was also deceased. He looked into the second bedroom himself and saw the boy, who they would later learn was 9-year-old Gavin Coleman, lying face down in his bed. The words, "fuck you," were scrawled in red spray paint on his bed sheets. The officers heard Chris yelling from the first floor, "What's going on?" They went back downstairs and walked Chris back outside. Barlow sat him down in the driveway and said, "Chris, they didn't make it." Chris said, "What do you mean they didn't make it?" and started to cry. The scene became chaotic. More officers showed up, along with an ambulance. The paramedics went inside, but nothing could be done. Sherry and her two sons had already passed away. The officers put crime scene tape up around the house while neighbors began to gather. Officer Zach Hopkins did a walkthrough of the neighborhood, questioning neighbors about what they had seen or heard, if anything, from earlier that morning. One neighbor told him that he woke up at 5:30 and let his dogs out. He said his dogs are very sensitive and would have barked if they had heard anything, but they didn't until police arrived around 7. Another neighbor said that she was a good friend of Sherry's. She was crying when she learned what had happened. She said she had texted Sherry earlier in the morning at about 6:30 and had never heard back. She also told Officer Hopkins that the Colemans had been having marital trouble. She said she had overheard Chris say that if it wasn't for the kids, he would leave her. She said Sherry gave Chris an ultimatum about his job and being home more, or else she would leave. Meanwhile, Jonathan Peters, the police chaplain, came to the scene to console Chris. He walked him over to the empty ambulance and had him sit inside, out of the public's view, as a large crowd had begun to gather. Chaplain Peters noticed that there was a bruise on Chris's right forearm and two fresh scratches that were red. He asked him what happened to his arm, and Chris said he didn't know. Chris then asked Peters what happened to his family, and Peters told him that he wasn't sure. Chris responded, "I was only gone an hour." He then yelled, "What do I do now?" and struck the mattress on the stretcher with both fists. Chris was very cooperative with detectives and agreed to go to the police station to be formally interviewed. He gave them the clothes he was wearing, his cell phone, and his computer, and authorized them to open up his mail and search his house and car. He also sat down with them for nearly 6 hours while they questioned him, and questioned him, and questioned him. What Chris didn't know when the interview started was that Detective Barlow already had his suspicions about who had killed Chris's family. When he had examined the bodies, they appeared to have been dead for a while, much longer than just the hour that Chris was gone. In fact, he suspected that they had been killed prior to Chris leaving, and that Chris himself was the killer.
So when did you first hear about what happened to Sherry Garrett and Gavin?
I was in college at the time. I went to Eastern Illinois University, so I was about 3 hours away from Chicago, but again, kind of closer to the St. Louis area. It was the end of the school year, beginning of May, and it was the end of my sophomore year, so I was studying for finals, and my brother was over at my apartment complex with two of my roommates, and he got a Facebook message, and the Facebook message said, you know, "Joe, I'm so sorry. I can't believe this happened. You know, I hope you're doing okay." And we didn't hear anything about it. And my brother messaged back and was like, what are you talking about? And the person then found out that we didn't know yet. So they kind of retracted their story and they were like, "Oh, sorry, wrong Joe. I was trying to get in touch with somebody else." We were like, "Oh, okay, fine." So then later on, kind of a little bit time goes by and another Facebook post comes up from another family member that said, like, "Rest in peace, Sherry, Garrett, and Gavin," that kind of thing. And we were like, "Whoa, you know, what's going on? What's happening?" So we looked it up on the internet, or my roommate looked it up on the internet, and it was the first thing that popped up. So we kind of found out in a really crappy way. I just remember falling to the floor, like sobbing hysterically. The whole reason behind it, my parents were there that day to move my brother out of his dorm. And they didn't want us to find out until we got home from school the next day, because we were going home that next day. I had one more final in the morning and then we were going to go home. So my parents were there and they were around us and they knew that what happened, but they were trying to not tell us until we were able to go home. But it was kind of, you know, social media got kind of in the way of that. So we found out kind of in a crappy way, but, you know, we called our parents and we tried to get as much information as we could. And we went home right away. You know, obviously my professor was understanding and I was able to go home.
In his interview with detectives, Chris walked them through what had happened earlier that morning. He said he woke up at 5:30 to go to the gym and that Sherry and the kids were still asleep when he left. As he was leaving the house, he saw a car backing out of a driveway several houses down the street, but didn't see anyone else on his way to Gold's Gym. He said he called Sherry's cell phone on his way as he was passing the Jefferson Barracks Bridge, but didn't get an answer, so he left her a message. He then texted her and called her about 3 or 4 more times while at the gym, but got no response. He started getting nervous, so he left. And while he was driving home, he tried calling her again. No luck. So finally, he called Detective Barlow. Initially, Chris told the detectives that his marriage was good, but as the questioning intensified, he admitted that towards the end of 2008, they were having problems, but he said they had worked them out through the help of counseling. And now, things are going awesome, he said. The detectives asked Chris about the scratches on his arm. He told them he got one set of scratches a few days earlier, but wasn't sure how it happened. He said he got the abrasion on his arm after hitting his arm on the gurney in the ambulance. Not long after discussing the injuries, Chris asked the detectives for a jacket or a blanket, saying that he was cold. After a while, one of the detectives told him that they doubted his story.
When you left the house this morning, was your wife alive?
Oh, yeah.
What would you say if I told you that I don't think she was?
I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, I think she was. And she was.
Okay.
She was laying right beside me.
Right. And I'm not doubting that. I'm not doubting that you were there, and I'm not doubting that you care. But I am doubting that she was alive when you left this morning. Physically, what we have are different ways to tell how long a person's been deceased. Mm-hmm. That was done. And what do you think that showed?
I don't know. I guess the time frame when I was gone. I mean...
No, you guess wrong. Chris, we need to get this resolved, okay? You can't argue with physical evidence.
Right. I'm not trying to argue with it.
All right. What I'm telling you is there is no other explanation. There's no other reason that the information we have would support what you're telling us. That it can't. It can't. You've told us a story, and we've gone over it numerous times. Right. You know what? We walk out to Justin. Maybe we missed this. Let's go in and talk to him about this and just make sure that we're not missing something. Let's give him every opportunity to tell us exactly what happened and maybe we're missing something. Right. So that's why we go out and we come back in and we go out and we come back in. Right. I did have to use the restroom. That was legitimate. But we go out and we come back in. And we felt very comfortable that we were giving you every opportunity to tell us something that was going to contradict the information that we had. All right, we've got this information, you're saying it, and we're giving you an opportunity to give us something contrary to what you told us before, so that, okay, yeah, all right, that would make sense. That hasn't happened.
That hasn't happened.
They pressed him even harder.
Listen, man, she wasn't alive when you left.
She was alive. She was laying right beside me.
Listen to me. We can go back and forth with this all day long, but the physical evidence doesn't lie. She was not alive when you left this morning. The children weren't alive when we left this morning.
Yes, they were.
No, come on, Chris. We gotta get over this. Now there's reasons, and that's the point we're at. I wanna hear the reasons. Now's when we need to find out what happened, man. It's so important. You're at a great point to be able to help us to try to figure this out. We already know what happened. We need to know why it happened.
I don't know what to tell you. You do
know what to tell us.
No, I don't.
Come on, Chris. She was not alive when you left. The children were not alive when you left. You know that's true, and I know that's true.
No, it's...
We need to clear this up now. We need to clear it up now. Did something happen? What happened?
Nothing happened.
What was going on in your life, Chris? Because I can't buy what you're saying. The physical evidence does not lie, Chris. It does not. She was not alive when you left, period. The physical evidence does not lie, man.
What do you want me to tell you?
How did we get to this point? That's what I need to know. I need to know how and why we got to the point we're at right now. We both know you're not telling me the truth. We both know that. I've done this a long time. I'm looking into your eyes, and I can tell you you're not being truthful, Chris. We need an answer. We need our answers. As bad as this sounds, as bad as this looks, or you may think it looks, we understand, and I've talked to many people who have given me reasons, and it's like, you know what? Okay, all right, I can understand how somebody might have been feeling that at that time. And maybe they acted on it, and they shouldn't have, and they regret it. There's no way to turn clocks back. You can't turn clocks back. You understand that, don't you? You can't turn the clock back. The only thing we can do is go forward from this point, and we need to know what and why it happened. Come on, Chris, help me out with this.
I'm telling you, I've already told you. I've told everybody. I told the guy in the ambulance. I told you. I told him.
The more we go back like this, the more it makes me think that there maybe even isn't a good explanation for it. I mean, we need to know what happened. We can't keep going on this. It didn't, you know, she was alive when I left. We know that's not true, and there's nothing we can do about changing that. If we know she wasn't alive when you left this morning, there's got to be an explanation. Now is the time to tell us. Now is the time to get this out of the open.
I don't know what else to tell you.
Yes, you do. Yes,
no.
You do. You have to tell me the truth, Chris.
I'm telling you the truth.
Were you involved in her death?
No.
Okay. Was someone you know involved in her death?
I don't know.
Did you know Did you talk to anybody about arranging her death?
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
He was then asked if he had been seeing anyone else outside of his marriage.
Had you seen anyone else outside of your wife in a romantic way?
No. Tara in Florida that you guys already talked to, I've talked to her a ton lately. But
and what's with that? I mean, what's
just a friend, somebody to talk to.
Okay. What would you guys talk about? I mean,
whatever.
Any particular problem or just in general talk?
No, just general talk.
Would you like, under different circumstances, to have gone further?
Yeah, it'd have to have been totally different circumstances. Obviously, I would have to have met her before I met Sherry.
Tara Lintz was a cocktail waitress from St. Petersburg, Florida, who was also an old high school friend of Sherry's. The detectives asked if he was doing anything with Tara that Sherry wouldn't approve of, and he responded, "Some of the conversations, probably." When asked if it had the potential to go further, he said, "No, I don't want to do that to my kids." Meanwhile, during the interview, detectives in the major case squad were already contacting detectives in St. Petersburg, Florida, who went to go meet with Tara to check out Chris's story. Tara turned over her BlackBerry and laptop computer, which contained many communications between Tara and Chris that obviously went beyond just friends. So the detectives in Florida communicated back with the detectives in Illinois, who were still interviewing Chris. They let them know that it seemed as though Tara was, in fact, Chris's girlfriend. Detective Barlow confronted Chris back in the interview room and told him that homicide detectives in Florida were talking to Tara right now and that they had seen pics and videos the two had sent to each other. And not only pics and videos, but they discovered that the two had actually taken trips together, including a trip to Hawaii in the months prior. Chris told them that he didn't think it was an affair. An affair is like when you're living with them and you're going to get married and everything, he said. After nearly 6 hours, the interview ended. But although the detectives were now full-on suspicious of Chris, not only with the emergence of the affair and the scratches on his arm, but also the fact that he never once asked how his family had died, something the detectives found odd. But they didn't have enough evidence to make an arrest, and so Chris was allowed to leave. But before he left, he voluntarily submitted writing samples and gave consent to search his BlackBerry. But the damage to Chris's reputation outside had already been done. Word had gotten out about the affair, and Chris went from looking like a grieving husband and father to a possible murderer of his entire family.
At first, it was more of a process of like, oh my God, this actually happened, instead of thinking like, oh my God, who did it type of thing. But once the dust kind of settled and we went home, and I kind of remember my dad is he was very close with her as well. And I think he knew right away that it had to have been him. But no, that wasn't the first initial reaction or, you know, kind of first thing on my mind for a while. But kind of after, like I said, after the dust kind of settled and, you know, and things kind of started slowly but surely trickling out. And there were some things, we weren't able to, you know, do, and that they were being very kind of sketchy on Chris's side. And that really kind of solidified it for us. Like, okay, something's not right here.
Chris's behavior definitely wasn't striking Sherry's family as normal, even when it came to Sherry and the boys' funerals.
You know, we were trying to get them to wait and hold off on the funeral so that we could make arrangements to get down there. All of Sherry's family is from the Chicago area, which is about 5 hours from Columbia. It's not, you know, Columbia, Illinois, not close. So we were really trying to get them to hold off and to wait so that we could all make arrangements to get down there. And they refused. And they were not cooperative with us at all. And they just went ahead and did, you know, the funeral right away. And we were not able to get there. So we had to go to court as Sherry's family to get the bodies then to come to Chicago so that we could have our own, funeral. So that was definitely a red flag and, you know, as a little bit of time went on, we kind of, you know, we're starting to realize, hey, I think he wants to get them, you know, buried before they start to investigate and, you know, things start to come up.
And meanwhile, the investigation into the murders continued. And when talking to Chris and Sherry's friends, family members, and coworkers, many of them said that Sherry had confided in them that Chris wanted a divorce, that Chris had told her she was ruining his life, but that he was afraid he would lose his job at Joyce Meyer Ministries if he divorced her. 2 weeks into their investigation, on May 19, 2009, Chris Coleman was arrested and charged with the murders of Sherry, Garrett, and Gavin. I'll be back with the trial testimony, including testimony from the responding officers, the pathologist, and Tara Lintz, the woman who was having an affair with Chris, right after this quick break from our sponsors. Driven by the mission to provide a better place to sleep for everybody, Lisa is an innovative direct-to-consumer online mattress brand that is also socially conscious. In fact, for every 10 mattresses Lisa sells, they donate one to a shelter through their 110 program. And they also plant one tree for every mattress sold and donate 1% of each employee's time to volunteer for local causes. Not to mention, with a patented universal adaptive feel, Lisa is designed for all types of sleepers and features three premium foam layers, including 2-inch Avena foam top layer for cooling and breathability, 2-inch memory foam middle layer for body contouring and pressure relief, and 6-inch dense core support foam for durability and structure, which works for sleepers of all sizes. And now, Lisa is continuing to expand its offerings to include the Lisa pillow, blanket, foundation, and frame. No wonder it's a Forbes top 20 startup to watch. Try a Lisa mattress in your own home for 100 nights risk-free. Available in the US, UK, Canada, and Germany online with free shipping, this 100% American-made mattress ships compressed in a box right to your door. Or you can try it at the Lisa Dream Gallery in Soho, New York City and Virginia Beach, and over 80 West Elm stores nationwide. Get $160 off when you go to leesa.com/junkie. That's leesa.com/junkie. And I have to tell you guys about my newest time-saving trick. The last time I ordered my contacts, I got my contacts lens prescription renewed right from my couch in under 5 minutes using an awesome new app called Simple Contacts. Simple Contacts lets you renew your prescription and reorder your brand of lenses from anywhere in minutes through an online self-guided vision test. Every test is designed and reviewed by doctors, so they are literally bringing the doctor's office to your home. Think of how much time you save compared to making an appointment, getting to the eye doctor, taking time off, etc. Better yet, the contact lens prices are unbeatable. The vision test is only $20 and the shipping is free. Just remember, this is not a replacement for your periodic full eye health exam, but it is definitely an easier way to renew your prescription right from home. And when I say easy, I really mean easy. You just download the app, take a quick vision and eye redness test, and within minutes, you're reordering your contact lenses. It couldn't be more convenient, especially if you're someone who is busy trying to finish up all their podcast episodes before they go on maternity leave, like me. Best of all, my listeners get $30 off their first Simple Contacts order. Just go to simplecontacts.com/junkie, or you can enter the code junkie at checkout. Again, that's simplecontacts.com/junkie, or just enter code junkie at checkout for $30 off your contacts. Heading into trial, the defense fought hard to keep out certain evidence. They requested what's known as a Frey hearing regarding forensic linguistic analysis. The state had indicated that they were planning on introducing evidence that would show that Chris sent those death threats to himself, and that he had also been the one to spray paint the threats throughout the home where the victims were killed. The state was planning on calling an expert to the stand who would testify to this, but the defense was arguing that it wasn't an accepted science, and that to allow this expert testimony would be unfairly prejudicial. After hearing all the arguments, the judge ruled that the state's expert could be called, and he could note the similarities between the emails, letters, and spray paint with Chris's known writings, but that they could not provide an opinion as to the authorship by a specific person. The defense also wanted to exclude evidence of sexually explicit text messages, emails, photos, and videos that Chris and Tara had exchanged that were taken from Tara's possession. The court ruled that three sexually explicit videos could come in, with the caveat that private parts be blacked out. The same with any photos. Chris's trial started in April of 2011, and by then, he was looking a little different.
He had sort of this very solemn look about him. He grew his hair out. He was a very intimidating looking guy. He was bald. I mean, he was a head security guard. So all the times that I've known him throughout, you know, my 19 years of life, he was bald. He was very muscular, big build, just super, like I said, intimidating looking, like a security guard, like how you would see somebody, you know, a professional or a personal security guard. In the courtroom, he lost a lot of weight. He had like a hair. He grew his hair out, so it looked. He just looked like, and you could tell that this was kind of a tactic, a defense tactic. But it looked like he was like a sad, sorry little man sitting in the chair, type of thing. Like that's definitely what they were trying to play to. So he sat there, very like solemn, his head down, never spoke, never really looked up.
One of the prosecution's main strategies was to prove that the victims had all died before Chris left his house at 5:30 that morning. So they called the responding officers, paramedics, and pathologists to the stand in the hopes of driving home their theory. Two of the first officers to the scene, Jason Donjon and Steve Patton, testified about what they saw when they entered the home on May 5th, 2009. Spray paint that read, "I am always watching," and "You have paid" on the staircase walls leading up to the bedrooms, and "Fuck you" in Gavin's bedroom. Photos of the spray-painted messages were shown to the jury. Donjon described finding Sherry's body lying face down on her stomach in the bed of the master bedroom. He said he knelt down next to her and pulled her hair away from her face. He attempted to get a pulse from her neck, but didn't find one. He described the skin near her neck as tough. He said he attempted to roll her over in order to see her eyes and to check for breathing, but when he lifted her shoulder, her neck and head moved also, as if they were locked in place. He noticed the skin on her chest and head area appeared to be reddish purple in color. A photo of Sherry's body was shown to the jury. Donjon said that as a police officer, he has investigated traffic accidents in which people had recently died, and while checking for a pulse, he typically found the skin to be soft and not thick or rigid like Sherry's was. He said he had also never seen a jaundice color or pooling of blood or bruising like he did on Sherry. Donjon said he then walked into the rear upstairs bedroom where Detective Barlow was and saw 11-year-old Garrett lying in his bed. A photo of Garrett's body was then shown to the jury. There was spray paint in the room and on Garrett's hand and arm. He said the skin around Garrett's eyes and mouth was purple or blue, and the skin on his neck was thick and tough like it was on Sherry, and that his skin was jaundiced and reddish. Donjon testified that when he went into Gavin's room, the 9-year-old was lying on his stomach in the bed. A photo of Gavin was shown to the jury, with the words, "Fuck you," spray-painted in red on the covers. Donjon said Gavin didn't have a pulse either, and that the skin near his neck seemed tough too. His face was slightly purple, and his arms and hands appeared grayish in color. On cross-examination, Donjon admitted that he had no training in determining time of death, and he also said that he didn't talk to Dr. Nanduri, the pathologist who performed the autopsies, or Dr. Bodden, who gave an opinion as to the time of death, about how Sherry looked when he found her body. Officer Patton gave similar testimony. He recalled the spray painting on the wall leading upstairs, and specifically said he remembered the word "bitch" being one of the words. He testified that he could hear Chris yelling something from downstairs, so they went down and told him not to come upstairs. He said Chris cooperated and they escorted him outside. He said once Detective Barlow told him that his family was gone, Chris started to cry, but made no attempt to go back inside the house. The two paramedics who responded to the scene both testified that all three bodies were cold, stiff, and that rigor mortis had set in. One of them said that in his experience, most bodies that have rigor mortis have been down for a while. But on cross-examination, he admitted that he didn't put anything in his report about rigor mortis having been present. Deborah Van Nida, a supervisory investigator with the coroner's office, testified that she entered the Coleman residence at 11 a.m., and at 11:08 a.m., the ambient temperature in the bedroom where Sherry was found was 76.6 degrees Fahrenheit. She did a liver probe on Sherry at 11:09 a.m. and found Sherry's temperature to be 90.4. The ambient temperature in Garrett's room was 75.2 degrees, and Garrett's core temperature at 11:23 a.m. was 91.8. She said the core temperature of Gavin's body was not established because there were long strands of hair on his body and spray paint, and she said she wanted to preserve that evidence. Dr. Raj Nanduri was the forensic pathologist who performed autopsies on all three victims. She testified that she found ligature marks, bruising, and abrasions on the necks of all three victims. She said she concluded that all three died as the result of ligature strangulation. On cross-examination, Chris's attorney, Jim Stern, asked if she had been asked by the prosecution to give an opinion as to the time of the victims' deaths. She said yes, but that she didn't give them one. She said the time of death is a range, and she said she was not comfortable giving a time of death because she didn't have all of the findings. She testified that she was aware that another pathologist had given an opinion as to the time of death, but in the thousands of autopsies she had performed, she knew of no other case in which another pathologist was hired to give such an opinion. She had not been contacted by the other pathologist to discuss the case. On redirect, Dr. Nanduri said she gave the range of time of death as 6 to 8 hours prior to 11:04 a.m., based only upon Sherry's body temperature at that time. She said the formula for deciding cause of death can be anywhere from 1 degree per hour of temperature drop to 2.5 degrees per hour. 8 hours would have made the time of death 3 a.m., and 6 hours would have made it 5 a.m. She said it would have been helpful to know the responding police officers' observations as far as rigor mortis, liver mortis, and their tactile experience in touching the bodies, but that she didn't have that information when performing the autopsies. Dr. Michael Bodden, who many of you may know from the Drew Peterson or O.J. Simpson cases, testified next, and Dr. Bodden had no issues with testifying as to the time of death. Dr. Bodden, who estimated that he had performed over 20,000 autopsies in his 45-year career, said that there are three cardinal ways to determine the time of death: rigor mortis, lividity, which is the color of the body after death caused by the settling of blood, and body temperature. He said the major case squad assigned to the case contacted him in May 2009 for his opinion as to the time of the victim's deaths. He said he was given the following information. There were three victims, and the husband and father of the victims had said that he left the house 1 hour and 15 minutes prior to the police having arrived. The officers said the bodies were cold, rigor mortis was present, and there were changes in the color of the bodies, which sounded like lividity to him. Based on this preliminary info, he opined that all three were dead before 5:43 a.m., when the husband left the house. He said it's often difficult to establish the time of death, but in this case, it wasn't a close call, given that the only real information the police needed was whether or not the victims died before or after 5:43 a.m. The police then provided him with hundreds of crime scene and autopsy photos, police reports, and Dr. Nanduri's autopsy report. He said he could tell from the crime scene photos that rigor mortis and lividity were present in all three bodies at 11 a.m. With regard to the photo of Gavin that shows hair that is longer and a different color than his on his body, Dr. Bodden testified that examinations performed on the hair showed that the longer hair was consistent with Sherry's hair, which indicated to him that the mom was strangled first and that the hair was transferred to the ligature to Gavin's body. Dr. Bodden told the jury that the same cord was used to strangle all three victims. He said Sherry's left eye appeared swollen in the autopsy photos, something Dr. Bodden said happened some time before she died. He said Sherry was killed first, then 9-year-old Gavin, then 11-year-old Garrett. He opined that the deaths occurred before 3 a.m. and definitely before 5 a.m. He said he believed that they were dead many hours before the first responders got to the scene at 7 a.m. On cross-examination, Dr. Bodden said that different factors can push the body temperature down, including ambient temperature, skin exposure, nudity, and weights. However, he also said that the entire total would not cause more than a degree or two of difference. He explained that temperature in a body does not drop for the first 3 or 4 hours after death. It remains at 98.6 degrees and then starts dropping. So even if Sherry's body was dropping at the rate of 1.5 degrees per hour, as was indicated by the two liver probes, the time of death was still before 5:43 a.m. Detective Sergeant Justin Barlow testified about the surveillance camera he installed in his home the day after Chris had reported yet another threatening letter in his mailbox on April 27, 2009. He said the camera was pointed out of his 5-year-old daughter's window directly at the Coleman's mailbox, and that police told Chris about it. He recounted for the jury how he received a phone call from Chris at 6:43 a.m. on May 5, 2009, saying that he was 5 minutes away from home and that he hadn't been able to get in touch with Sherry. Video surveillance from the camera was then shown to the jury. Sure enough, it showed Chris leaving his home at 5:43 a.m. It then showed Detective Barlow arriving at 6:51 a.m. Chris then can be seen returning home at 6:56 a.m., 13 minutes after Chris had called him. Detective Barlow then testified about what he saw when he made entry into the home. He said there were no signs of forced entry and that he had brought moisture into the house with him on his tennis shoes when he entered through the basement. He testified that when Chris came into the house, he asked what had happened, but nothing else. He didn't demand to see his family, nor did he try to go upstairs. He went outside with the officers and cried, but Detective Barlow said that no one ever told Chris what they had actually found upstairs. He said Chris was at the scene for about 20 to 25 minutes until he was taken to the police station. A copy of the nearly six-hour interview was then played for the jury. Chris detailed for the detectives the normal day his family had had the day prior to the murders. He said Sherry cooked chicken and pasta for dinner while Chris played catch in the yard with Garrett. They then took the boys out for snow cones. Chris then went to the gym, came home, and put the boys to bed. They brushed their teeth and said their prayers. Detective Barlow said that during the interview, Chris never asked how his family was killed, and that approximately 4 hours into it, Trooper Bivens, the other officer conducting the interview with Detective Barlow, specifically asked Chris if he knew how his family had died, and Chris said he didn't know. Detective Barlow told the jury that during the interview, Chris asked for a jacket to cover up his arms, even though Barlow didn't think the room was cold. And at one point in the interview, when the officers walked out of the room, he said Chris picked up one of the officers' notes and looked at them. On cross-examination, Detective Barlow acknowledged another report of a threatening letter on April 6, 2009, but that letter was never brought to the police department. Chris was in Hawaii with Joyce Meyer Ministries at the time. Detective Barlow also acknowledged that Chris had provided police with body and handwriting samples, but he said that 25 minutes into giving the samples, Chris said he was tired of writing, so police told him he could stop. Chris also gave the police the clothes he was wearing, his cell phone, and his computer, and authorized the police to open his mail and search his house and car. Detective Barlow admitted that Chris was being treated as a suspect during the interview. Ken Wodovich, an officer with training and experience in computer forensics, testified about the photos and videos that Chris and Tara, the woman he was having an affair with, had sent to each other in the months leading up to the murders. He said they found several hundred images, including hundreds of explicit images, depicting either Tara or Chris in various stages of nudity. Four of the explicit photos were shown to the jury, with the private parts obscured with a black box. Wojtowicz said he found several videos on Chris's laptop, which depicted either him or Tara without clothing. Some snippets were shown to the jury, with the explicit parts blocked out. Wojtowicz testified about what was occurring in each one. Also found on Chris's laptop was a note in the form of an email. The same note was also on his BlackBerry. It lists Tara's birthday, height, eye color, shoe size, ring size, jean size, favorite flowers, and perfume preferences, as well as her likes and dislikes regarding food and sports teams. Next to the word Christmas, it states promise ring, loves, circle diamond, or diamond cross. And another entry states our daughter's name, Zoe Lynn Coleman. Additional notes were shown to the jury in which Tara had updated Chris's calendar with when she got her period, her dog's birthday, and Chris's birthday. And perhaps most notably, an entry made on November 5th, 2008, which read, "The day Tara changed my life." This was just 9 days before the first threatening letter had been sent.
It surprised me. It shocked me because I thought, wow, you know, I thought, like I said earlier, that they really had a good relationship and they were really communicating well and starting to. And then this whole idea came out of this whole other life that he had. And that it shocked me how much the affair. I'm like, okay, it's an affair. But the detail that he had of things like, you know, when he's going to marry her, how many kids they're going to have. What's their dog's name? What's her, you know, shirt size and clothing size and hair, you know, the day she changed his life, things like that. That was just mind-blowing. It was absolutely mind-blowing.
Officer Wojtowicz also testified about the threatening note found in the Coleman's mailbox. He said the word opportunities in the letter was misspelled. So he did a search of Chris's computer and found several hits of several different files that had the word opportunities misspelled in the same way it was in the letter. Chris's writings with those misspellings were then shown to the jury. Tara Lintz was reportedly a very reluctant witness for the prosecution. Her testimony lasted about a half hour, and she managed to leave the courtroom without talking to a single reporter. She typically gave yes or no answers to the questions that she was asked. But here is what she said in her testimony. According to Tara, she and Sherry were best friends in high school and stayed in touch after. In November 2008, Sherry called her and told her to go to a Joyce Meyer Ministries conference that was being held right by where Tara lived. She said she saw Chris there, and afterwards, they started talking on the phone and texting each other constantly. They started a physical relationship with each other in mid-December 2008, when Chris was again in Florida with Joyce Meyer. Tara met him at a hotel in Orlando. She said they communicated constantly between November 2008 and May 2009, and they told each other that they loved each other. They also met in Arizona and Hawaii while Chris was on business for Joyce Meyer Ministries. She would stay in his hotel rooms with him. She told the jury that she and Chris planned on getting married after he divorced Sherry. The plan was for Tara to move to Illinois, and she said they even got matching promise rings. And she told the prosecutor that she was wearing hers as she testified. She said Chris told her that he had talked to an attorney about getting a divorce and that he was scheduled to pick up the divorce papers on Monday, May 4th, 2009, and was going to give them to Sherry. But Chris didn't give the papers to Sherry on May 4th as planned because he told Tara that Sherry's name was spelled incorrectly on them. He said the attorney was correcting it and they would be available the next day, May 5th, the day of the murders. Tara said that she and Chris had been planning on going on a cruise to St. Thomas in June and that they had already purchased the tickets with his personal credit card. On the evening of May 4th, 2009, She said she talked to Chris on the phone and then they texted constantly until Chris told her that he was going to bed about 10:30 p.m. She said she didn't have any contact with him on the morning of May 5th. But Chris's dad called her at about 10 a.m. and told her that Sherry and the boys had been murdered. Chris then texted her while he was being interrogated at the police station and later called her that evening after he left. 2 days later, she said Chris called her again while she was talking with Illinois detectives who had come to Florida to question her. When she told Chris that she was being interviewed, he said, "Oh, really? Interesting." She said either he told her or she told him that police were looking for a motive. She said she didn't talk to him again. On cross-examination, Tara was asked about other men she had been seeing during the time frame that she and Chris had started their affair. She acknowledged that she had received sexually explicit photos from Chris's brother and that Sherry's brother had contacted her on social media and asked her to marry him. She also acknowledged taking a cruise with another guy in December 2008. She also testified that she had used Chris's computers on occasion. The next few witnesses were from Joyce Meyer Ministries, who knew about the marital issues between Chris and Sherry. A woman named Christine testified that she was good friends with Sherry and was also employed at Joyce Meyer. In December 2008, Sherry texted her and told her that Chris wanted a divorce because he believed that she was messing up his work life. But prior to that, in mid-December 2008, Christine said that Chris messaged her and told her that Sherry had sent him some provocative pictures on his work BlackBerry, and he wanted to know if those pics could be seen by the ministry's staff. Christine handled the ministry's cell phones at the time. She said she wasn't sure, and so she checked with their technical staff and was told that no one could see the pics, so she told Chris. But after Sherry had told her that Chris wanted a divorce, she got suspicious and told her brother, who also worked at the ministry. He then informed Daniel Meyer, Joyce's son, who told her to check Chris's phone. She checked the phone records and saw that Chris had made numerous phone calls and text messages to a Florida number and had received calls and text messages from the same number. She said Daniel was going to follow up with Chris about it. Christine testified that Joyce's policy regarding employment after an adulterous affair is such that, quote, "In most circumstances, they probably wouldn't be allowed to work there anymore if they were having an affair." She told the jury that she knew of one employee who was fired for that very reason. On cross-examination, Christine said that she was aware that Chris and Sherry were going through counseling with a pastor and that Sherry had told her that they were doing better afterwards. She said as far as she knew, Chris was a good father. Megan Turnbow testified that she used to work with Sherry at Joyce Meyer Ministries, and they remained friends after Sherry stopped working there. The prosecutor was careful with questioning Megan, and it soon became apparent why. The prosecutor asked if Megan could tell him about one specific occasion that had been allowed by the court. He asked, "In November 2008, did you have a discussion with Sherry about her relationship with Chris?" Megan said yes. He then asked her to tell them what it was about and approximately when it occurred. Megan responded, "I received a text message from Sherry that stated that Chris had beat her up," and the defense immediately cut her off with an objection. At the sidebar, the prosecutor said that Megan was not supposed to testify in that manner. The judge sustained the objection and instructed the jury to disregard that testimony. Megan continued with her testimony and said that Sherry told her that Chris wanted to leave her and told her that she had ruined his life because he couldn't leave her due to his position at Joyce Meyer Ministries. Megan said it was the company's policy to terminate any employee who was having an adulterous affair while working there. On cross-examination, Megan admitted that Sherry and Chris had gone through counseling and that afterwards, Sherry had told her many times that things were getting back on track. After Megan's testimony, the defense moved for a mistrial based on her response about Chris beating Sherry, but the judge denied their motion. Kathy LaPlante was another good friend of Sherry's who used to work with her at Joyce Meyer. In early 2009, she said Sherry told her that Chris wanted a divorce because he was tired of her and that she and the children were keeping him from his destiny and from what God wanted him to do. On the Friday before Sherry and the kids were murdered, Kathy was at the Colemans. Chris told her that he had a working surveillance system in the house. Chris and Sherry both told her that they had a video of an unknown person putting something in their mailbox, but Sherry told Kathy that there was really nothing that could be seen on it. Kathy said that Chris had been looking into some other job opportunities, such as starting a gym and his own security firm, but that he stopped looking after he got a raise in January 2008. Two other friends of Sherry's confirmed that Chris told her in late 2008 that he wanted a divorce and that she and the boys were getting in the way of his career. A woman named Susan Boyd, who worked as a recruiter in the HR department at Joyce Meyer Ministries from 2004 to 2008, showed the jury a script that was used when interviewing applicants. In a part of the script, they were instructed to ask the applicants if they were divorced since being born again, and if they were, to ask them about the circumstances and whether there were any biblical reasons for the divorce. Specifically, it said, quote, "Anything against biblical principles, such as married people in adultery or single people living with the opposite sex, would be grounds for termination." Susan said she knew of one employee who had been fired from the ministry due to an adulterous relationship. On cross-examination, Susan acknowledged that there were employees who worked there who were divorced. Joyce Meyer and her son Daniel both testified via a pre-recorded video deposition. Joyce recalled her relationship with Chris. She said she has known him since his parents would bring him to conferences when he was a little boy. He became employed with her in 1998 and then eventually became her personal security guard who traveled with her. She said he was making $100,000 a year and had a company laptop computer and cell phone. She said she didn't know that Chris had been having an affair until one of the detectives told her as they were interviewing her. She said she was aware, however, that Chris and Sherry were having marital issues. Sherry had called their office one day and had asked them to talk to Chris about it, so she did.
What he told me is that he felt that Sherry was very controlling, that no matter what he did, she wasn't happy, and that they just in general, you know, were not getting along, and that he was just really tired of it. And at that point, I asked him if, you know, they'd be willing to get some marriage counseling from a pastor that we have at our office, and right away he said yes, they were willing to do that. Which they did do.
Joyce said that in the spring of 2009, Chris told her about the threats he had been receiving and that he was concerned because the person knew where he lived. Joyce said she originally spoke with police about the case on May 6th, but that on May 12th, she requested to speak with them again.
About a month prior to the beginning of May, say during the month of April, I just felt like he wasn't, I was just noticing that he wasn't as attentive to his duties. He was forgetting things that were just not normally him. And just in general, not quite as engaged. I noticed a personal cell phone in his car one day that was being charged up. And I asked him about that because I'd never seen him with it because he had a ministry phone. That was what he carried all the time. And he just said it was a personal cell phone, and I started asking other questions, and then I just thought, you know, it's really none of my business if he has a personal cell phone, so I let that go.
Did he, during that period of time, ever call in sick for work?
On May the 4th, he called and told me that he wasn't feeling good and asked if he could take the day off.
May the 4th, 2009?
Right.
Was that unusual for the defendant?
Yes. He was, I mean, he worked for us 11 years, so I can't swear that he never took a day off, but I didn't remember him ever calling me and saying that he didn't feel good and wanted to take off. He was just always there.
And how were you informed on May the 4th, 2009, that he wasn't coming to work that day?
He called me in the morning and asked me if he could take the day off.
Okay.
Joyce then addressed Chris's affair.
I have to ask you, if the defendant were having an affair, if you had known that at the time, and I understand you've testified that you didn't, what effect would that have had on his employment?
If he would have been having an adulterous affair while he was still married, then it could have definitely affected his job.
On cross-examination, Joyce said that Chris was an excellent employee who started the security division from the ground up. She said in August 2008, Chris asked for time off for his 10-year anniversary, but he was denied due to a previously planned convention she had out of town. She said to the best of her knowledge, Chris loved his children and was good to them. Joyce's son Daniel testified that he became concerned about Chris's cell phone bill because it was increasing. So he had the records pulled from the ministry's financial department and found that there was a particular phone number in Florida that Chris was calling, even while traveling internationally. Daniel said he called the number and a woman answered the phone. He confronted Chris, who said the number belonged to a friend of Sherry's and that he had been calling her husband to seek marital advice. Chris told him that he could check with Sherry, but Daniel said he accepted the explanation. Daniel said he knew about the threatening letters and that he had offered to have Chris stop traveling or to have increased security at Chris's house while he was traveling, but Chris declined. Daniel said that there is no policy at Joyce Meyer Ministries that divorce itself is grounds for termination. Jonathan Peters, the chaplain for the Columbia Police Department, described Chris's demeanor as he consoled him at the scene. He said Chris was stoic after he broke the news that his family had been killed and that he was absolutely not hysterical. Peters said that on the way to the police station, Chris looked down at his right arm and said, "How did that get there?" referring to some marks on his arm. Photos of the marks were then shown to the jury. Peter said he later saw Chris hit his arm on the gurney in the ambulance, but said there was no way the marks were from that, as they were there prior to him hitting the gurney. Michael Brown, a forensic scientist, testified that he examined fingernail scrapings from the victims and from Chris for DNA. Fingernails from Sherry's right hand contained male DNA, and none of the Coleman males could be excluded as the source. There were no significant DNA findings from the fingernail scrapings of the boys or from Chris. Rick Soddy, the testing lab manager for MI Windows and Doors in Pennsylvania, testified that he does certification testing for all of MI's windows and doors. The basement window at the Coleman residence was manufactured by MI and contained a forced entry resistance plate on the bottom, meaning that if someone had tried to open the window while that forced entry plate was locked, there would have been damage to it. He said the Coleman's window showed no damage and showed no signs of being forcibly opened. The prosecution focused on the threatening letters next. Officer Ken Wodovich was called back to the stand, this time to testify as an expert in the area of IP addresses. He testified that the account destroychris@gmail.com, which had sent the threatening emails, was created at 8:19 p.m. on November 14, 2008, on Chris's laptop computer that was recovered from his home. He testified that the very first email had been sent on November 14th to a number of different Joyce Meyer Ministry email addresses with the subject line, "Fuck Chris's family, they are dead." Then the next day, on November 15th, 2008, an email was sent to Daniel Meyer and to Chris's email accounts and states, "I know you all got my fucking email. You think I'm full of shit. Just wait. I will shoot their asses with my 40. Kill them all. I'm so sick of bitches like her taking everybody's cash so she can fly her jet and paper her white ass. Fuck you all. Tell Chris I will kill them. He has no idea when, but it will happen." On cross-examination, Wodovich admitted that he doesn't have a degree in computer science and that most of his training was from classes taught by law enforcement. He also said he didn't search Chris's laptop for remote access software, which could have allowed someone to run the computer from a different location, nor did he check for malware or for viruses. But the next witness did. Marcus Rogers, a professor of computer forensics at Purdue University, reviewed several images of hard drives police gave him. He testified that only one computer can be issued an IP address at a time. He recited the IP address for Chris's laptop and said that no other laptop, no other computer connecting to the internet during the period of time that that laptop has the address can have it. He too said that destroychris@gmail.com was produced on Chris's laptop. He also said that the laptop hadn't been operated remotely, but had been turned on and off using a manual switch on the computer during each of the three sessions during which the emails had been composed. He said antivirus software on the computer was up to date, and there was nothing to indicate that the computer had any type of virus. On cross-examination, Rogers acknowledged that the laptop had been used many times since 2008 and that he didn't analyze everything on the computer. He also noted that there were 6 different user accounts on the laptop. Robert Leonard, a linguistics professor with a PhD in linguistics and director of the Institute for Forensic Linguistics Threat Assessment and Strategic Analysis, took the stand next. Leonard said he was asked to analyze and compare the threat letters with Chris's known writings. He said he found similarities between them, including contraction patterns, which included saying I'm instead of I am and don't instead of do not, fused spellings, which included writing the two words any time as one word, any time, apostrophe reversal, meaning the apostrophe came after the word, as in D-O-N-T apostrophe instead of D-O-N apostrophe T, and the fact that the word Y-O-U was written as just the letter U. And as for the threats written in spray paint, the prosecution addressed those too. Michael Harloff, a former color chemist at Rust-Oleum, said that samples of the spray paint taken from the home were from a can of Rust-Oleum spray paint. The color was apple red. And Carla Hine, a Columbia police detective, testified that a master credit card found inside the Coleman residence was used to purchase a can of apple red Rust-Oleum spray paint on February 9, 2009 at 1:46 p.m. The purchase was made at the Handyman True hardware store located in St. Louis, approximately 7.5 miles from the Coleman home. She said she went to the store and obtained a copy of the receipt, which was signed by Christopher E. Coleman. On cross-examination, Hine admitted that no cans of apple red spray paint were found in Chris's house, car, or any other place associated with him. Lindell Moore, a forensic scientist for the Illinois State Police, testified about the similarities between the spray paint writings found on the wall and Chris's known writings. He said there were 6 alphabet characters that contained similarities: I, G, C, K, B, and P. On cross-examination, however, he admitted that he couldn't tell if the spray paintings had been written by one person or two, that he had just assumed that they were made by the same person. He also couldn't tell if the person was right or left-handed and said it's difficult to compare spray painting to handwriting. And with that, the state rested their case. Chris's defense team called Stephen McCassin, a document examiner who had previously worked for the Illinois State Police and the Postal Service, to the stand. McCassin testified that the writings on the wall appeared to have been disguised because there was a lack of normalcy. He said this was evidenced by the mixing of capital letters and small letters and cursive and printing. Because they were so disguised, he said it would be pretty unreliable to draw any conclusion other than inconclusive from that comparison. Ronald Butters, a professor of English and anthropology at Duke University, testified that there were problems with Robert Leonard's analysis. He said that any similarities in the writings were linguistically meaningless and that the 4 categories provided by Leonard were useless. He agreed with the FBI's conclusion that it couldn't give an opinion as to similarities between the writings. He said Leonard should have refused to testify about this at all because it wasn't scientifically valid. And then the defense rested. After at first declaring that they were a hung jury, the jury deliberated further and found Chris guilty on all 3 counts. Chris was sentenced to 3 concurrent life sentences.
Just relief, like overwhelming amount of relief. Again, I was not at any point surprised. I was just happy and thrilled that we were able to kind of now start putting this behind us and focus on, you know, having Sherry, Garrett, and Gavin's memory be what we're talking about and what we are promoting and keeping alive, because the trial, you know, took, not that it took something away from them, but we were focusing on somebody who shouldn't be focused on, and we should be focusing on, you know, those 3 people. So I was elated. It was a wonderful, wonderful feeling, like I said, to be able to know that we can start putting this behind us. There's justice, and we can all start to move forward.
One thing I always think about when following these trials and seeing the victims' families in court is how they must feel about people who don't even know them, supporting them.
When we walked out after the verdict was read and they were putting, you know, Chris in the police car and you know, taking him away, people were screaming and cheering and clapping, and people were hugging us, and, you know, just strangers were so unbelievably supportive. And same thing with all of my friends and family members who weren't there. You know, through social media, we were able to kind of keep everybody updated. And that was something that was like so unbelievable and so humbling, that so many people were so invested in this story and in this case that we felt the support from all over the country. And that was an incredible feeling too, just seeing people so elated for us that we were able to kind of close this out in a good way.
Jurors spoke to reporters after the trial was over and talked about their deliberations. They said their first vote was 7-5 not guilty, but as they started looking through all of the evidence and talking it out, that changed, especially when they discovered something themselves on one of the photos of Chris and Tara that had been shown to the jury. They had been given thumbnail versions of the photos with date and timestamps on the back of them. The jury requested a magnifying glass, and they used that magnifying glass to look at the backs of the thumbnails, and what they saw, they said, definitely changed some minds. On the back of one of the photos, the date was marked October 21st, 2008, which was before Chris and Tara had said the affair had started. That, the jurors said, made Chris and Tara not credible and made them think, if they're lying about that, what else are they lying about? Now, this has given Chris and his attorneys reason to file a petition for post-conviction relief, which they did just this past April. They argued that the jurors shouldn't have been able to see the date on the photographs since that part hadn't been entered into evidence, and since the jurors stated that that helped change their minds. Chris is also asserting actual innocence and is asking for an evidentiary hearing, and that after the hearing, for his conviction to be reversed and a new trial granted. And while Chris had been filing his appeals, a new theory of the case emerged from a former detective in Montana and author of a book about Edward Edwards, a serial killer. The former detective and author has publicly stated that he believes that Edward Edwards is the real killer of the Coleman family and that Chris is innocent. But it's a claim that Jenna and the rest of Sherry's family is calling absurd. Jenna said people still contact her to this day about how hearing about what happened to Sherry, Garrett, and Gavin has affected them in a positive way.
And I've had people reach out since say that they're, you know, Sherry's, that story, that case has inspired them, and they've, you know, gotten help. Either they're in an abusive relationship and they are finally, you know, they feel like they can talk about it, or that they're going to go get help, or things like that. That is, and that's the best gift, that out of something so terrible and so horrible and tragic, that something like that kind of comes and helps you kind of deal with that and be able to be like, okay, this, you know, why did this happen? But it's helping people. And that's really all we can ask for.
What advice would you give somebody who, you know, may either see some red flags or have suspicions about a loved one's relationship? You know, so maybe if they're listening to this and they're like, oh, you know, I have this friend or cousin or sister, whoever, who I suspect might be in a similar type of relationship, what sort of advice would you have for them?
Reach out to them. That would be my number one piece of advice, is just to reach out. If you suspect anything, not to be, you know, accusing or anything like that, but just reach out. Just ask if they're okay. Do they need anything? Even just for them, that other person, to know if that you're there for them. Because ultimately, if they're not ready to share their story or they're not ready to get help, they won't. So it's just a matter of being that support system for somebody, and you know, reading up, getting research, reading about those red flags, knowing what to look for, things like that. Because Sherry did confide in some people, in some of her friends, and this is in no way on them. It is not their fault whatsoever, but the fact that she felt comfortable enough to reach out to them, I think, is really important. And I think that you just to be there for them, that would be my number one piece of advice for sure.
Jenna also suggests donating, if you can, to battered women's organizations and shelters, anything to help make a difference. And that's all for this episode. I want to thank Jenna Miglio and her friend Jamie for reaching out to me about this case. And thank you to Jenna for interviewing with me. As a reminder, this is my last episode I'll be releasing until August 20th. I'm taking a maternity leave, but we'll be back in August. I also have a few case update episodes that I'll be releasing in the meantime, so make sure you're subscribed to Court Junkie so you don't miss out. I want to say a heartfelt thank you to all of you for all of your support. I truly do have the greatest listeners in the world, and I already can't wait to release my next episode. But in the meantime, let me know what you think about this case by joining my Facebook discussion group at courtjunkie.com/Facebook, by tweeting me at courtjunkiepod, and by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. Also, consider adding Court Junkie on Instagram, as I will be posting some pictures of my brand new Court Junkie as soon as she is born. Thanks again for listening and for helping make Court Junkie what it is. Until next time.